Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening.
Hello, I'm Jasmine Williams, one of the producers of If You Love This Planet. I'm introducing the show today because our host, Dr. Helen Caldicott, is featured in this week's interview. For over 30 years, Dr. Caldicott has described the consequences of radiation and nuclear power. The following interview was recorded by Mariah Gallardin from TUC Radio in Oakland, California, in June 2009.
Good to see you, Helen.
Thank you.
This is about your new book, or your revised book, and it turned out that I thought about the title a lot, and If You Love This Planet has become such an important title in your work. It's a book and a film.
And a radio show.
And a radio show, yes. Do you remember what you thought and felt when you first came up? Put these words together.
I was giving a speech in Plattsburgh, New York, and I was so tired, and it was just near a strategic air command base, so B-52s kept flying over loaded with nuclear weapons. It was really creepy. And I turned up and there were Klieg lights everywhere, and the Canadian Film Board, or the National Film Board of Canada, was there to film me, and I thought, I just can't do this. I'm so tired. Anyway, they wired me up, and I gave my speech. And at the end, I said, if you love the lilacs, and you love the roses, and you love the wisteria, you'll save the world if you love this planet. It just came out of my mouth. So they called the film If You Love This Planet, which subsequently won an Oscar, but has been virtually banned by the US Justice Department as foreign propaganda, although I gave a speech in New York. And it's only about the medical effects of nuclear war. And you've got to register with the Justice Department if you want to play it. So all Canadians have seen it, but virtually no Americans. And so after that, I wrote a book. I was ready to write a book about the state of the planet, and I called it If You Love This Planet. And then so I've just revised that book, If You Love This Planet, and then I started a radio show about a year and something ago, a year and 4 months, and called it If You Love This Planet. So it seems to meld into everything.
So the first book came out in 1992.
Yes.
What motivated you to update it? What has changed?
I had two people on my case wanting me to update it, and I didn't want to update it. It's actually harder to update a book than it is to write a new one. So finally I was convinced, I don't know how or why, but so I did it. And when I updated it, everything that had been predicted in the literature scientifically had come to pass. And so I felt like calling it I Told You So. And I always feel if I write a book, everyone will read it and that'll fix the problem. It's just fantasy.
Well, in a way, it's written that way. It's explains every single problem in depth.
Yeah.
So everybody can draw their own conclusions.
But Norton's only printed 4,000. I mean, if it takes off, they'll print lots more. So everyone needs to buy it.
What was the biggest shock when you looked more closely at the environment?
Oh, I think the global warming situation is far beyond any of us understand. The International Panel for Climate Change wrote a report that was published earlier this year, I believe. And but the trouble is it's 5 years old, because by the time all the scientists of the world get together and agree on every phrase in these reports, it takes 5 years. So this report is 5 years behind. And it's scary enough as it is. But new stuff coming in with the Arctic ice melting and the Greenland ice cap melting and temperatures of the sea rising and extraordinary weather events and the Antarctic's melting. Now, there was a report from London, I can't remember the institute that put it out very recently, that said that it's possible the temperatures could rise by 3 or 4 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. Well, that's doom. We won't be... And along with this gradual rise in temperature, of course, we get catastrophic weather events that just occur randomly. And so it's like the human body. You might be on a curve upwards in terms of cardiac failure, but something can tip you over. And so it's not a smooth transition to cardiac failure. All sorts of things can happen along the way. And it's the same with the weather. So societies could be easily drowned as both the sea level rises, the tide rises, and enormous storms are triggered. And one third of the human race lives at sea level, and it's thought that the worst possible situation could be that the oceans rise 15 metres, and that's about 45 feet. I mean, that's the worst case scenario, but you see, being a doctor, I always think of the worst case scenario to prevent that happening, and if you don't, you're going to miss out on curing the patient.
You know, I thought of you, we all thought of you, when we heard the news from Australia first in the spring, the incredible fires, and then more recently in September 09, the dust storms. What are your personal experiences and observations about those catastrophes?
Well, the fires were in Victoria, where I used to live, and it was really like a holocaust, a nuclear holocaust. The air was so hot, it was spontaneously igniting, and embers would fly 5 kilometres, which is, 2.5 miles or something, a bit more, and a house over on the distant mountain would suddenly burst into flame. So the heat generated more heat, and it was absolutely unstoppable. And they had previously warned people not to leave their houses and to protect them because they had sprinklers on the roof, which I do, and cleared all the litter away. But that didn't matter. The houses just burnt spontaneously. And that's what would happen if there was a nuclear war. And then, of course, the winds rush in to feed the fire. So you have hurricane force winds plus this enormous fire. And the noise, they said, was like a hurricane coming. And the heat was so intense that if you were outside, you would be burned almost to death by just the thermal radiation not being ignited. Over 180 people were just incinerated, so much so that their teeth burned as well. So they didn't leave their bones or teeth behind to be identified. So that was earlier this year. And then we had this dust storm. People in Sydney woke up and all of Sydney was red. They couldn't see through the air. Well, a dust storm comes from the drought in central Australia, drying the ground, and in the dust is contained the topsoil of the desert mostly, in which there are lots of organic elements and little insects and fish eggs and insect eggs and the whole thing. But also that dust storm originated in an area where we've got the biggest uranium mine in the world, Olympic Dam, and about 85 million tonnes, I think, of waste lying in a huge mound. And, of course, it's very dusty, and some of that dust would have contained tailings, uranium, radium, radon gas, and it probably came as a plume within the dust storm. And people are saying, well, don't worry, it'll be very dilute. But if you happen to inhale some radium or radon, it's not dilute for you because just a very small volume of cells get a high dose of radiation. And anyway, the solution to pollution by dilution when it comes to radiation is fallacious because it reconcentrates back in the food chain. The other place that is a little west of there is a place called Maralinga, where the British were allowed to blow up their hydrogen bombs. And they also emulated broken arrow experiments, meaning that if there's an accident with a nuclear bomb, what happens? So they literally scattered 24 kilos, they're 2.2 pounds in a kilo, so 40, 50 pounds of plutonium over the area. There's been a bit of an attempt at clean-up, but not much. And, of course, the windstorm could blow the plutonium over Sydney, and it was the whole of the East Coast, actually. I was recording one of my programs, and I looked out the window, and the mountain had suddenly gone pink, and it was at dawn. And I thought, well, that's funny. I can hardly see the mountain, and it's pink. What's that? Well, it was the dust storm that went right up to Queensland north. And plutonium, of course, is one of the most deadly substances on Earth, such that 10 to the minus 6 grams is carcinogenic, but 10 to the minus 9 grams, a nanogram, may be carcinogenic, and it should never, ever be in the atmosphere, and it happens to last for 500,000 years. So the plutonium that would have been blown up in that dust storm, and we've had two since that one, and obviously it's a prelude for more to come.
Two more dust storms.
Yeah. Mm.
And all, you know, the fires and dust storms were preceded by this incredible drought.
Oh, we've got an awful drought. Where I live, which is near the sea, and we've got forests and stuff, it's so tinder dry. And the forestry department, God rot their socks, were burning off at the base of this beautiful mountain called Mount Dromedary, or Goolaga in language, Australian Aboriginal language. And they burnt off and it was smouldering for 4 weeks. They never really put it out. Then came a tremendously hot day and fierce winds. The whole mountain ignited. The whole mountain. And the smoke was so thick, you couldn't see the mountain, you couldn't see anything. And it went out to the ocean and it enveloped us. And people were saying, oh, well, you know, the Aborigines used to burn off, it's all right, it'll regrow. That's not the point, because now we've got global warming. Millions of tons of CO2 were lofted in the atmosphere, which increases global warming, which increases the drought, which increases the heat, which will increase fires. And so we've got a feedback loop, a vicious mechanism that will, and the hotter it comes, the more fires we're going to see in Spain and Greece and in California and in Australia. It's just madness. And the IPCC report and other such reports saying one way to reverse or halt or steady global warming is to leave the trees in place, because the trees are just stacked full of carbon. And it takes a tree 500 years to reach its maximum carbon capacity. And of course, when you burn them, it turns into CO2, Bob's your uncle. And when you plant new trees, they don't suck up nearly the amount of carbon that an old tree does. So we should be not only retaining our forests, but planting millions more trees. When I wrote If You Love This Planet years ago, it was estimated if an area the size of Australia was planted with trees, we could reverse the CO2 back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the atmosphere. Well, of course, we can't because it's all desert, but you could. And the United States has an area the same size as Australia. I can see what's happening at home is the sort of redneck aphorism says, if it moves, shoot it, and if it doesn't, chop it down. So if it's a kangaroo, you shoot it, and if it doesn't move, you chop it down. And what they're doing is chopping our forests down, which we own, the Forestry Department, and it's a big deal with the federal government, and we're wood chipping it and sending it off to Japan to be made into Vogue paper. That's obscene, and then the paper gets burnt. And those trees that are exported, they're not counted in our equations and estimations of how much global warming Australia produces. And in fact, we produce more CO2 per capita than anyone else in the world.
We meaning?
Australians.
Were you able to make these arguments in Australia in connection
with... No, I get no media in Australia at all. They're not interested in talking to me, which I have to say is incredibly frustrating, because that's my country. I helped to stop uranium mining for 5 years. I helped to stop the French testing weapons in the Pacific. I had a very big profile in the 70s, and then I left and came to the United States and worked here. And I think what happened was that sort of the industry just gradually moved in like an amoeba and just took over the politicians. And now we are mining uranium like there's no tomorrow, which actually, I didn't mean that pun, there probably will be no tomorrow, because any country that buys our uranium and builds a nuclear reactor has a bomb factory. And so we get lateral proliferation of nuclear weapons, which destabilizes the balance of terror between Russia and America, who happen to own 97% of the about 28,000 bombs in the world.
But, you know, looking at it from the outside, you assume these catastrophes in Australia at least would be a wake-up call.
Yeah, but I can't get any media, Mariah. I mean, how do you teach people without access to the media? You can't. And, you know, they'll cover you if you take your clothes off or if you do something quite startling. But if you talk sense, all they have on are the corporations debating, you know, the right debating with the far right about how good uranium is and how much it'll add to our GDP.
Just a little aside, I am to tell you from Patch Adams that that event, when we all took our clothes off, was a really important and totally unforgettable day.
Yes,
in his
it
life.
Was wonderful, wasn't it?
Well, let's go back to your book because that's a forum for you to speak. You begin both editions with a chapter on ozone depletion. And now today people tend to think that's a problem we no longer need to worry about because we have the Montreal Protocol, etc. What do you say?
Well, it's going to take about 40 or 50 years for the ozone to recover. It certainly seems to be recovering a little. The hole over the South Pole isn't quite as large as it was, although it tends to vary year by year. HCFC, which was made to supplant CFC, which caused most of the destruction, which is used for refrigerators and propellants in spray cans and blow up plastic for furniture and stuff, foam, the plastic. It's 21 times less toxic to the ozone than CFC, but it's a potent global warming gas. The other thing is that there are other elements that destroy or compounds that destroy ozone, but specifically a gas that's used to make flat screen TVs. And it's extremely potent. And CFCs are 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent than CO2 as a global warming. And this new gas, and it's nitrogen something, it's in this book, is also a very potent global warmer. And the scientists who are working on global warming have suddenly found out about it, and they're just freaked out, totally. So the ozone is, I think, over time, I think the Montreal Protocol was incredibly successful and could serve as a model for global warming. But it's going to take a long time for the ozone to recover. And in the meantime, 1 in 9 Australians get malignant melanoma, and I think it's 1 in 93 Americans. And we have just a skin cancer epidemic. There are skin cancer clinics on many corners in our suburbs. People are getting cataracts. I've had one cataract done. I've got to have the other cataract done. That's partly caused by ultraviolet radiation getting in from the sun with the very thin ozone. And we get things on our eyes called pterygia, growths on our eyes. So, yeah, it's pretty bad.
Another difference from the first to the second edition is you extended the chapter on toxic pollution and you added peak oil. Why did you do that?
Well, because peak oil, we think, occurred in 2005. It's a wonderful man called Heinberg who's been researching peak oil, meaning that in 2005, the world was producing the maximum amount of oil which it possibly could, and now the supplies have dwindled, and it's much more expensive to find, drill, and suck out more oil than it was way back. So they're going to more expensive and less available sources. But what interests me so much is that oil is used to make all the plastics and the detergents and the fertilizers. Almost everything in our life is dependent upon, including transportation. Suddenly occurred to me the other day, all the radioactive waste sitting at those reactors, 64,000 tons or more, we leave to our descendants because we don't know where to put it now, but they can't transport it if there's no oil in the world, because how do they move the stuff? We're using it like there's no tomorrow, which there may not be. And if we like plastic, which I'm very concerned about plastics and the toxic materials that leach from the plastic bottles into the drink and into the food and the like, well, we should be conserving oil, and we've got to stop driving cars like this, because we just have to stop burning oil, because we're in a catastrophic tipping point where global warming is actually now a certainty, and it's how far it's going to go. We've gone from 280 parts per million at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution now to 387 parts per million. Now, the sort of the dean of global warming, called James Hansen, says that we've got to go back to 350 parts per billion to have any hope of salvaging our normal lives. Whereas the governments of the world are saying, well, we think we'll sort of aim for 450 parts per billion. Well, that's going to be catastrophic. And my government's totally manipulated by the coal companies, the natural gas companies, and the uranium companies. They don't really care. And I can't really understand it. And the same with Congress now with the climate change bill. Because if I have a patient who's in the intensive care unit, critically ill, you don't muck around and make compromises because you might make a bit more money or you can't afford to give them this sort of antibiotic. I mean, it's all or nothing. And we're in the situation where it's going to be all or nothing.
Well, the power of corporations, that takes me to the chapter on the manufacture of consent in your book. And I was so happy to see that there, not only because I so fondly remember you introducing us to the person who first brought up that term, Alex Carey, in the late 80s at the Palace of Fine Arts. Do you remember that?
I remember
evening?
The Palace of Fine Arts. And I guess I remember talking about Alex Carey. And I remember I had a bright pink coat and I was talking about the slaughter of elephants. And I remember lying on the stage in my bright pink coat, pretending to be a dead elephant.
You know, I forgot that. But Alex Carey, I never forgot, because one of the things you got across that night was that there is a huge countervailing force to democracy, and that's corporate propaganda, and that people aren't really, I mean, we're complaining about people not getting an education, but here we have a phenomenon where people are being miseducated on a huge scale.
Since the First World War, totally propagandized. How come they think this is the greatest country on earth? The corporations learned after the First World War, using the same propaganda they taught the Americans to hate the Huns, and they took that into corporate business affairs, and they found that you can't sell Pears soap by saying, look, it's nice soap, smells nice, it's good. They found that if they sold Pears soap by saying every good American uses Pears soap and there's a flag waving gently in the background, that appealed to people. So that's how everything's been sold all these years since the end of the First World War, 1918. And you can look at any product. I hate that word product. Anything, any rhubarb that's sold is sold in the name of America. American, you know, nationalism. The corporations worked out, I'll read this. In 1945, the corporations invented a new method to sell their capitalist philosophy, which they called techniques for community ideas. It's nothing to do with the communities. These people are wicked. They discovered that the American people were not very excited about the rather sterile concept of capitalism or free enterprise, but that they did exhibit a rather positive emotional response to the notion of Americanism, which is what I've just described. From this new information, the corporations devised a formula that tied many fundamental values together. So here's the first equation. Free enterprise equals freedom, equals democracy, equals family, equals Christianity, equals nationalism, equals God. Most Americans believe in God. Actually, most Americans believe in money. But the equal and opposite formula goes like this. Egalitarianism equals equality equals government interference. Oh, you mustn't have the government interfering. Equals socialism equals unions equals communism equals Satan.
Satan.
Satan. These formulas became the backbone of corporate philosophy and profit-oriented activities and propaganda, and they've been used ever since with undiminished success. Just watch TV carefully for one night and you'll understand. A big, tough, hairy guy hefts a can of beer, the ad implying that all red-blooded Americans drink this brand of beer. The scene fades with a patriotic music in the background. There may even be a suggestion of a US flag. Advertisements also imply that freedom and democracy are God-given, and the family is a fundamental unit of American society, and that all is well with the world if you buy the products in the ads. Say no more.
Well, people should be reading this now, because I guess there's no time ever where the power of corporations has become so obvious.
Yes, so powerful. Yeah, they should read this, because not only do I describe the pathology infecting the planet and affecting the planet now in some detail, but I describe why. In other words, you can't cure a disease unless you know what cures it, and that's called etiology, the etiology of a disease. So I get into the etiology of the disease affecting the planet, which is the media, which is determining the fate of the Earth. The corporations propagandizing and brainwashing and practicing social engineering and psychological engineering through the ads. Who owns the media now, the power of the media? And the media actually uses public airwaves for their rubbish. And they're very persuasive, and people are lazy, and they sit on their couches and watch. I mean, I go to a hotel these days and there are 56 channels. Can I find anything worth watching, except maybe if I happen upon the BBC? I always, when I'm tired, I want to find MASH, because that makes me happy. Radar, and who's the guy that dressed in girls' clothes? That was so funny. You can't find anything I can't find anything that's worth watching. And what an opportunity to educate people. And it was the wonderful Dennis Potter who wrote The Singing Detective, who was British, who understood the power of television way back and tried to use it to educate people. As he was dying, he was interviewed by a BBC reporter. He was dying of pancreatic cancer, and he had psoriatic arthropathy. So bad was his arthritis. He had a cigarette stuck in his hand and a flask with morphine in the other. And he was giving this interview and intermittently swigging at the flask or smoking, and he said, dying, he said, I look out, I can eat cream. I can drink what I want. I look out and there's a blossom tree. It's the blossomingest blossom tree I've ever seen. And he called his cancer Rupert. And he said, Rupert Murdoch is the most dangerous man in the world. With that, I concur. And he's one of my fellow countrymen, who helped create my career.
How so?
Well, when I started talking about the French tests in 71, 72, he quoted me in front page editorials in The Australian, the national newspaper. But then 2 years later, when I moved on, or 3 years later, into uranium mining, the curtains went down. He was actually very progressive, very early on, and then it seemed like he had a sort of psychotic breakdown or a brain tumour or something, which he clearly actually didn't have. But he changed from being very progressive and a socialist in a way to becoming extremely conservative. And now he's married with two little girls. Wouldn't you think that he'd use his media to save the planet for his daughters and his other children?
Well, there are a few who think they can get away, whatever happens.
He's highly intelligent. His son James has been on to him about global warming, but, you know, on nuclear power and destroying Obama the way they're doing, that's obscene. How dare they?
Well, let's go back to corporations overall. I mean, this is such an eminently teachable moment. We can't get health care because of corporations, pharmaceutical and HMO corporations. We can't get a change in energy policy because of oil and coal.
Well, I have to talk about the healthcare. Fancy obscenely developing a healthcare industry we take the Hippocratic Oath. We teach, we care for our patients whether they can pay for it or not. We're a service profession. We're here to help. And if the patients can't pay, they're so grateful, I'll give us a chicken or a cake. Or for corporations to step in and steal the money that should be going to all the people in this country to care for them. And in Australia, we've got a free healthcare system. In New Zealand, in Canada, in France, in England, in Germany, in Sweden, they've all got free healthcare systems. You've got a free killing system. You pay your taxes to the Pentagon and the military industrial complex nearly $1 trillion a year if it's all added up. Yeah, and that's socialism. It's really even communism, let's be frank. But if you want healthcare, sorry sport, you have to pay for it. And we don't want the government to interfere. Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. We've got one of the best healthcare systems in the world in Australia. I mean, if you get sick, my friend broke her knee recently, had the best orthopaedic surgeon in Sydney, had an anaesthetic, was in hospital for a week with everything that she needed. She got a bill for $700, of which I think she had some private insurance which paid half of it.
So are there efforts in Australia, as there are in Canada, to privatise that system?
Well, there's a little bit, but now that we haven't got that man, John Howard, as our Prime Minister, who was pretty bad, those efforts are receding. Yeah, I don't think our healthcare system... You can buy private insurance if you want to go to a private hospital and have wine with your meals and be well treated, but at night you might die bleeding to death because they don't often have... labs and residents. If you're really sick, you go to a public hospital and get the finest care in the world.
In your solutions chapter, you, in the first and also in this edition, you're really focused on the political process, on voting and on campaign finance reform, etc. And that's actually interesting because if you look at other people's solutions, it's like change your light bulb and...
Well, you can do that too and get a Prius or electric car and put solar panels. Actually, the government should be putting solar panels on every single roof in America, solar hot water systems, stop subsidising coal, stop spending any money on nuclear power plants. Everyone should have an electric car made in China. All parking lots should be covered with solar panels. Plug your car in during the day and charge it up, you know, and drive it home, plug in your house and charge up your house from solar energy. There's so much, and the money going into killing, the killing industry, should be redirected into the saving the life industry, which is to prevent global warming. Windmills, there's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply the whole country with electricity twice over. And so it has to happen through the political process. You practice preventive medicine through the political process. How do we immunise people against swine flu, against polio? It was all paid for by the federal government, as it should be. And so the only way... See, the politicians are not our leaders. They're our representatives in a democracy, and we own them, and they must represent us. But if we are lazy and passive, and sit on our couch and, you know, we're too busy... then they are manipulated, guided, bribed, and paid for by the corporations. That's the way it is now. So it doesn't mean to say that they won't change. If you make politicians frightened, they won't get elected. They listen. During the era of the Freeze campaign in the 80s, which I think was the second American Revolution, by God, they got frightened. We didn't quite get there, but they were frightened.
Have you seen solutions that you really liked in other countries?
Yeah, I mean, I've led three revolutions, I suppose. Well, not revolutions, but one revolution. One was the campaign against French tests, and the Australians rose up en masse. They just think the French are arrogant anyway. But so much so that 75% were totally opposed to a spontaneous marches in city streets. It was amazing. They wouldn't buy French perfume, French wine, French cheese. And we took France to the International Court of Justice with New Zealand. So she was forced to test underground. So what did Jefferson say? An informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. So I learned a lesson. Then I educated the union movement in Australia about mining uranium because Murdoch wasn't interested, neither was the media. And I, you know, and I couldn't get through to them because they said we need the jobs till I started educating them about the medical effects of radiation upon their testicles. And that turned the Australian union movement round. So that was the second, and they banned uranium mining for 5 years. That was pretty spectacular. Then I came to America and I founded Physicians for Social Responsibility, and we got 23,000 doctors who started to say nuclear war is bad for your health. And everyone said, no, we don't want to be red, we'd rather be dead. What? Yeah, and I said, well, so what about the pygmies in Africa? They said, well, yeah, they don't want to be communists either. So we started doing the bombing run and dropping bombs on various cities and melting people's eyeballs and vaporizing them and the whole thing. And suddenly people started waking up saying, my God, this is bad for our health. And at the end of 5 years, 80% of Americans had moved from better dead than red concept to they were totally opposed to nuclear war. That was peaceful, sagacious, Gandhian, Martin Luther Kingish, a revolution. It was a revolution in America, the second American Revolution. And there were no minute men. Or maybe I was a minute woman. But yeah. I didn't fire a shot that was heard around the world. I'd like to quote from Walter Cronkite, who put a spontaneous outpouring I'd like to quote from Walter Cronkite, who had a spontaneous outpouring following the election of George H. Bush, George I. He said, we know that Thomas Jefferson was right when he said, a democracy cannot be both ignorant and free. We know that no one should tell a woman she has to bear an unwanted child. We know that religious beliefs cannot define patriotism. We know that it is not up to how one's lips are formed, but what they say. And we know there is freedom to disagree with all or part of what I've just said. But God Almighty, we've got to shout these truths in which we believe from the rooftops. And Walter Cronkite was a friend of mine, a very great friend, and supported me, and I loved him. And he once said to me, you know, he said, I think we should unilaterally disarm from nuclear weapons. And he said, what are the Russians going to do, you know, come in and roll over the children with tanks, you know? And I said, but Walter, no one knows you think that. And I said, you're the most admired man in America. And he said, you know why I'm the most admired man? He said, because no one knows what I think. But he should really have told people what he thought. He got a bit more open towards the end of his life. And the other thing I'd like to read, just to sort of finish off this interview, is where I come from. The only cure is love. I just walked around my garden. It's a sunny fall day and the white fleecy clouds are scudding across a clear blue sky. The air is fresh and clean with no taint of chemical smells, and the mountains in the distance are ringed by shining silver clouds. Earlier, I picked a pan full of ripe cherry guavas to make jam, and the house is filling with the delicate aroma of simmering guavas. Figs are ripening on the trees and developing that gorgeous deep red glow at the apex of the fruit. Huge orange-coloured lemons hang from the citrus trees, and lettuces, beetroots and cabbages are growing in the vegetable garden. The fruits and vegetables are organically grown and feels wonderful to eat food that is free of human-made chemicals and poisons. It is clear to me that unless we connect directly with the earth, we will not have the faintest clue why we should save it. We need to have dirt under our fingernails and to experience that deep aching sense of physical tiredness after a day's labour in the garden to really understand nature. To feel the pulse of life, we need to spend days hiking in forests surrounded by millions of invisible insects and thousands of birds and the wonder of evolution. Of course, I realise that I'm very fortunate indeed to be able to experience the fullness of nature so directly in my own backyard. For many people, especially those living in urban areas who are unable to travel out of them regularly, such an experience is difficult to come by. Still, I urge all to try in some way to make a direct connection with the natural world. Only if we understand the beauty of nature will we love it. And only if we become alerted to learn about the planet's disease processes can we decide to live our lives with a proper sense of ecological responsibility. And finally, only if we love nature learn about its ills, and live accordingly, will we be inspired to participate in needed legislative activities to save the Earth. So my prescription for action to save the planet is this: love, learn, live, and legislate.
All right. Thank you. That's how we come back to if you love this planet. Another question I was curious about is, you're so much known as an anti-nuclear campaigner. Do you sometimes have to explain to people how anti-nuclear work and environmental work
are absolutely
connected?
And the two tie in together. Now, I always talk about global warming and nuclear power, and nuclear weapons and proliferation. And I'm not an activist. I'm a physician practicing global preventive medicine. I am a physician through my heart and soul. It is my vocation, like being a nun. I took the Hippocratic Oath when I was 17, and that's it. So we all need to take the Hippocratic Oath for the planet.
Actually, there is one line in your book that I really like. It's really simple. You're saying teachers should be paid more than physicians.
Yeah, doctors, yeah. Of course teachers should be paid more than doctors. I mean, look, we cure a sore throat sometimes and we march around like little gods. We're very arrogant on the whole, supercilious and patronising on the whole, not always. But we all really deeply care about our patients. And we can get people to live longer, but the most important people in society are the teachers, teaching the generations upcoming how to live, how to learn, and how to save the planet, and how to participate in democracy. These kids don't know. And so I think teachers should be paid much more than doctors. We're grossly overpaid. We shouldn't get rich by practicing medicine. How dare we? I've never earned much money. The most money I ever earned, probably, was $21,000 a year that I was paid at Harvard when I was on the staff. You know, you used to have to pay Harvard to employ you. But now they pay you some. Mm.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of learning, what I also like about the book is the huge index and the enormous appendix. When I went through it, I followed footnotes to see, you know, where the numbers came from, and I saw so recent publications quoted. It's almost, you know, like a telephone book.
It's an encyclopedia, yeah. Well, I had help with the index, and I had some tremendous volunteers who helped me with the research, and my publisher, W.W. Norton, was absolutely meticulous that every single reference be checked and that we find it on Google. And we did. And the index was made by one of my producers for my radio program, Scott Powell, and he gave a lot of time and energy to this and has produced an extraordinary resource for where to go to get help or to work on any single issue that's brought up in this book.
All right. There are two little things that I thought I'd ask you and paste in earlier. What do you think about carbon trading?
Carbon trading is ridiculous. It's mafia territory. It's Soprano territory. And it's failed bitterly in Europe. And it opens the whole thing up to absolute crooks. It's like the drug trade, you know. Why don't we legitimize drugs? And that would get crime out of it, and we could then put the people who are drug addicts in hospitals and treat them appropriately, and, you know, the problem would go away. So trading is just going to not just not work, but it's going to be a nightmare, and it'll do nothing. And in a study that I commissioned called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, written by Arjun Makajani, a wonderful physicist, he advocates that all carbon be taxed, tax is the right word. They don't like it, but it's true, at $100 per ton, fixed cap, fixed tax, 100, that'll fix it. They'll find it's not worth, you know, they won't make any more money using the atmosphere as their rubbish dump, which is exactly what they've done.
So how would that work, $100 per ton?
Well, the government, federal government, just charges every big corporation, and every coal company, and the ones that really pour out CO2, $100 a ton for CO2. Now, for ordinary people, I don't know how that would work. But the money collected, which would be in the billions, could then be used to build wind farms right across the country to upgrade the grid, which is sadly dilapidated and not available for renewable energy, to cover the deserts bathed in sun with solar panels, solar thermal systems, to tap the geothermal energy, to employ hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans, in a wonderful new enterprise to save the planet. The GDP would go right up, and America would truly become the energy superpower of the planet. And that's what conservatism means. We stay with the thing we know. That's what conservatives are. They're frightened of moving into the future. But in fact, I'm a conservative because I'm for conserving life. Period. There's the book, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. If you want to read it, it's absolutely stupendous. You can download it on ieer.org. And when I read it, no, when my assistant read it, she was sitting in a bath. And she got so excited, she felt like leaping out of the bath and running naked down the street like Archimedes did when he developed the Archimedes principle. This is it. This is the prescription. This is how we do it. State of Texas is using it. Utah, it's being referred to in the Congress with Pelosi and Markey. This is it. And when the nuclear industry and the coal industry put out the story that renewables will never produce base power, they are lying, and everyone's bought the myth. And it's like the tobacco companies, yeah, but we don't really know that smoking causes cancer. They are lying, and the people have been sucked in by these lies, and that's wicked. That's evil, wicked behaviour on a planet that's infected with lethal microbes, which are us, which are destroying the Earth.
So in your life, between your anti-nuclear and environmental work, there is this collision that has taken place right now where all of a sudden nuclear is put forth as a solution.
Well, you see, nuclear power is so complex that even many environmentalists like Stuart Brandt and James Lovelock don't understand it. How do I know about it? Because I was asked by the editor of the New England Journal in 1978 to write an article about the medical dangers of nuclear power, and I spent a year researching the literature, much of which came from the industry itself. It was really interesting, Journal of Health Physics. I wrote the article, which actually got rejected by peer review because they said, well, you didn't say what's good about nuclear power. Well, there's nothing good about nuclear power medically, but I became extremely well-educated. And I know more than doctors because this information is not taught in medical schools, which it must be, must become. I mean, if there's a meltdown at a nuclear power plant and Indian Point blows over New York, doctors haven't a clue what to do. They don't know. Well, actually, to tell you the truth, there's nothing you can do. You take the patients down into the autopsy room, take the clothes off and hose them down, hose off the isotopes that go in the sewage system in the hole in the floor, but you can't get the isotopes out of their lungs, their livers, their stomachs, their bones. But we should know about it so that we can start to rise up en masse and prevent it and practice preventive medicine. So I guess I'm one of the few people who really knows the subject in depth, and that's a tragedy.
For you?
No, for the Earth.
That's, you know, that's what Patch Adams expressed and said again. How do you bear it?
How do I bear it? Mm-hmm. It's funny because I used to be terribly frightened of nuclear war and I could feel the heat in my bones. I think I've reached a stage, I'm 71, of adaptation. And that's a medical term. If there's a nasty smell, after a while you adapt to it and you don't smell it anymore. If there's an awful noise, usually you adapt to it and stop hearing it. I think psychologically I've adapted to the dreadful possibilities. I have a clear conscience. I've done the very best I can. And I can look my grandchildren in the eye and they know that I'm trying to save the earth for them, my children, and all other children. So I feel clear and free, like sort of floating around. And if there's to be any miracles or something, maybe I'll get a second go at it to get on the media, but I don't know about that. Especially as I'm 71 and not beautiful like I used to be. So there you go. I don't know.
What is close to your heart?
My new baby.
See if I can zoom the camera into
his it. Name is Liam Sandars Jacob Caldecott.
And he was born
five months old. He's like a celluloid doll. He's just perfect. And he's soft and cuddly and smells of breast milk, and I could eat him.
You're listening to If You Love This Planet, and you've just heard an interview with the program's host, Dr. Helen Caldecott. Dr. Caldecott was speaking with Mariah Gallardin. She's from TUC Radio in Oakland, California, and the conversation was conducted in June 2009. Now on the program, you'll hear Dr. Helen Caldecott reading an excerpt from her new book, If You Love This Planet, which was published in 2009 by W.W. Norton.
We must be very conscious of the chemical composition of the food we eat. Our grandparents ate fruit that was not perfectly formed and perhaps contained a few worms, but it tasted delicious. The farmers began using sprays to kill pests and increase their crop yields. Before long, chemical companies got into the act and agricultural products became a large portion of their business. Initially, the yields of chemically treated crops increased quite dramatically, but over time the predatory insects and parasites mutated and developed immunity to the sprays. So the chemical companies developed new and more exotic poisons to combat this human-induced immunity. Despite these carefully applied chemicals, however, crop losses caused by pests have actually increased since the 1940s, from 32% to 37% by 1991. Meanwhile, the soil has been contaminated. As a result, worms and naturally occurring microorganisms that form the base of the pyramid of the food chain have been killed, and bees and birds that fertilize the crops have been poisoned. In a random sampling of fruits and vegetables in 1995, the US FDA discovered that 60% of the fruits and 37% of the vegetables had pesticide residue on them. About 2% of these fruits and vegetables contained pesticide amounts that exceeded maximum limits established by the EPA. It's a terrible thing to realize that the food we put into our mouths could be poisoning us. Amazingly, less than 0.1% of all pesticides ever reach the target insects. The other 99.9% is dispersed in groundwater, lakes, weirs, soil, and the air. Groundwater has been contaminated with more than 50 varieties of pesticides in some 30 US states. In a study on pesticides and water conducted in 1998, the US Geological Survey found that 95% of streams and 50% of wells close to agricultural and urban areas were contaminated with pesticides. The use of pesticides increased from £300 million annually in 1966 to more than £1 billion in 1988. The US now uses £1.2 billion of pesticides a year, and £5 billion a year are used globally. The World Health Organization estimated in 1995 that roughly 3 million cases of pesticide poisoning occur each year, two-thirds of them happening in developing countries, including 220,000 pesticide-related deaths, mostly of people who use or apply pesticides. Pesticides are also used by people as the leading method of suicide, according to WHO. The National Academy of Sciences reports that pesticides in food may cause 1 million cases of cancer in this generation of Americans. It was predicted in 1998 that on a yearly basis, 1 million Americans would learn they have cancer, 500,000 would die of cancer, and 10,400 Americans would die of cancer related to pesticides. All this ecological damage to grow unblemished, artificially beautiful food. I believe it's better to eat a sweet, chemically uncontaminated apple containing a worm than a visually perfect toxic apple that tastes like cardboard. Farming can be made safe. Organic farming relies on mulch, compost, manure, and naturally occurring pesticides, has been proven to be more productive than chemical farming. But that's true only if the water and soil used to raise the crops are absolutely not contaminated with chemicals. Before we can clean up our lives and cure the planet, we must recognise the extraordinary damage that our lifestyle inflicts on the planet. When I was a child, women wore silk stockings and silk rayon or cotton underwear. Floors were covered with linoleum or woolen carpets. China plates, metal cutlery and glass were used in the kitchen, and garbage consisted of food scraps wrapped in old newspapers. The trash can was a small lidded metal can that was put out weekly for collection, and once a week the iceman placed a block of ice in the top of our ice chest, which kept the food cold. The milk was delivered at 5 o'clock each morning by a milkman driving a horse and cart. Fresh bread was delivered at lunchtime, and Dad grew most of our fruits and vegetables. On the weekends, my father walked the streets with a bucket and spade, collecting horse manure to fertilise the garden. Our life was healthy and relatively free of artificial chemicals. When I was 8, someone showed me a nylon doorknob. It looked like a magic material, and intuitively I knew it heralded the dawn of a new era, the plastic age. With some trepidation, I watched the introduction of Laminex laboratory benchtops, vinyl floor tiles, plastic lavatory seats, plastic covered furniture, plastic piping for plumbing, plastic filled planes and cars, plastic disposable kitchen utensils, and plastic medical equipment. The gravity of the situation became apparent when I was a medical resident in 1972. I asked a hospital administrator why we used disposable plastic scissors, scalpels, forceps, and so on, instead of metal surgical instruments. He told me it was cheaper to buy plastic and throw it away than to employ people to wash steel implements. 40 years later, the situation is totally out of hand. I've witnessed the takeover of the world by plastic. Americans and many other people have become obsessed with bottled water. An average of 40 billion plastic water bottles are used each year in the United States.
On If You Love This Planet, you've been listening to host Dr. Helen Caldicott read an excerpt from her new book, also titled If You Love This Planet, published by W.W. Norton in 2009. Thanks for listening to the show today. Dr. Helen Caldicott will be back in the presenter's chair next week with a special guest. Go to our website for any information on the program. It's www.ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Thanks for joining us. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.